once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the Personal Wealth Coach Second Hour on this July 22nd, 2017. And if you'd like to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400, we'll welcome your call, even if you don't agree with us. And as long as we can hold a discussion, as long as you make a statement and we can make a statement and then you can make a statement and we can make a statement, one of the things we're not going to do is just go along with whatever somebody says, because we're kind of interested in facts and both of us have got a pretty good education. So we do have a caller on 773-1400 and you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, this is Paul. Hey, two things. One, you probably ought to get one of those buttons like the national players have, so you can cut somebody off and then talk and turn it back on and let them talk. Otherwise, you know, you'll have that guy talking all over you all day long. So just to, you know, I don't know if you have one of those buttons or not that you can turn them off, but you ought to get one if you don't.
Yeah, we do. We just kind of hate to do that.
Yeah. Well, you needed to do that last time. Second thing is, do you really believe that there's only one way to increase revenue, and that's increased taxes? Do you not prescribe to the fact that there is a, and I know it gets very complicated, that when you get to a certain level of taxation, your tax revenues go down?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. There's
and when you get it to a certain lower level, then the revenues actually go up, even though you're actually on a tax rate.
Absolutely.
Yes. Absolutely. That's called the Laffer point, by the way. That's the Arthur Laffer, who was the head of the economic council, the president of the Council of Economic Advisors to Ronald Reagan,
came up
with that.
The Tax Reform Act of 86, which, by the way, our current tax code is based on, took us pretty much to the Laffer point, where we had maximum revenue with lowered taxes. And as a result, if you recall, in the late 1990s, we were running a surplus. And then we came in.
And
did a tax cut.
Just real, throw this in here. Bill Clinton says, the Clintons took credit for the surplus, but it was a direct result of the tax changes that took place before Clinton was in office.
Under Reagan. And the point is that once you get there, once you get to that sweet spot, which we were in the 1990s, then the president, George W. Bush, who I happen to think very highly of, pushed hard and Congress agreed that we should cut taxes further because we had a little bit of a surplus, we could start to pay down our debt.
Totally rational,
and
except then we had a war.
And the point is that we...
Two wars.
Yeah, we cut taxes, and then we started spending a lot more money on a couple of wars and a prescription benefit, but we didn't raise the taxes back up to where they were before we cut the taxes, and then we started running big deficits. I mean, it's not a... Again, it doesn't take rocket science to figure out that once you hit the sweet spot where you've got taxes lowered and you're getting more revenue, and Arthur Laffer advised on that, and everything's running just right.
Don't spend more money all of a sudden.
If at that point you cut taxes and increase spending, you're going to start running a deficit.
Yeah. And here's the deal. The deficit side and the tax side are two different areas. Taxes, if you lower taxes, there's two ways you can get more revenue to the government for it. One, more people report their taxes. And two, more people make more money because they have to spend less to the government. On the other end, if government comes in and increases spending, well, that doesn't have an immediate negative impact on business, on the business world. Except that if the increased spending starts to put other non-tax-related red tape, regulation, restriction to business on top of it, then you get multiple pieces to that equation. Mm-hmm. We've got too much regulation. Taxes are probably too high, but spending is even much more higher than it should be.
But, just to keep it simple, we were running a surplus. We decided to do a tax cut. We all enjoyed the tax cut. That was in 2001. And 2002 timeframe, we did this tax cut. Beautiful. We all have more money to spend. And then we got into two wars and passed a prescription drug bill that was the most expensive entitlement we've ever passed. But we didn't raise the taxes back up to cover it.
And we'll come out and say this very clearly here. We were on the air at the time that the wars were started, and we were pro-war. So
yeah,
each of these things was a rational step when we said lower taxes. That was a great idea. We had a surplus. The government shouldn't have more than it needs. It shouldn't be a weight on society. Lower taxes. And that surplus came from a lowered and refined tax system. The tax code that we have right now, there are two parts of it that are a problem. One, it's way too complex. You don't know how much you owe. Even when you file and you think you got it right, how do you know? You don't. And the other end of it is it takes so much time to do. If the majority of the business time is spent on preparing the taxes, or even a month out of the year spent on preparing the taxes, not on paying the taxes, but on just getting ready to make sure that you know that you spent, or you have a good idea that you spent the right amount on taxes, that's a problem. So there should be a laugher point on that that doesn't exist on the overregulation of the tax code. We've got a lot of issues there. We could simplify and probably increase, just simplifying the tax code without raising the rates at all would probably increase revenue to the government quite a lot.
Yeah, but really,
that's a different issue.
It really boils down to the fact that we've had several things that Congress has voted to spend money on, major, we're talking about trillions of dollars, without raising taxes. Now, spending trillions of dollars on a war where the money mainly goes to Iraq and Afghanistan doesn't put more money into the United States economy.
Now, let me hit the point. Caller, you said there's a point where you can lower taxes and increase revenue, and there's another side of that where when you raise taxes, it increases revenue. One thing that I wasn't a big fan of this, certainly not a proponent of it, but in the Affordable Care Act, in Obamacare, it had a surcharge for people making $250,000 or more.
Couples, yeah. Couples. Individuals, 200, couples, 250.
Right. And that's tacked on to capital gains. It's tacked on to everything. There's 3% just added on to a bunch of different taxes. Revenue went up. So I don't like that tax. I think it was inappropriate. It was not in any way fair. It was targeted. It was a way of coming up with revenue to pay for something that got passed into law. So we look at it and we say, strictly from the measurement viewpoint, if you raise taxes and revenue goes up, it means that if you lower taxes in the same area, revenue will go down. That means that we're not at the sweet spot yet. We're on the wrong side of it. That's not true in the capital gains taxes world. When we raised taxes on capital gains, less money came in capital gains revenue to the government.
Well, actually, they raised it was an interesting
that
factor.
Surcharge going on to the capital
that gains. Surcharge going on to the capital gains produced more revenue, and the stock market went up.
It produced more revenue outside of capital gains. It didn't produce more capital gains revenue proportional to the raise. No. So that means that on the Laffer point, capital gains rates should probably stay at 15% people won't sell the item to pay the taxes on it.
We say 15%. Well, that's the federal capital gains. By the time you
states
in most states, most states have an additional tax on capital gains. So it's closer to 20. As a matter of fact, I was reading a paper that said the optimal tax capital gain rate appears to be, as far as the Laffer point is concerned, 20%.
Right.
Well, most of America pays about 20% if you had a 15% capital gains rate.
Right. But the people that pay the most capital gains taxes are paying proportionally less taxes than the raise because they're taking less money because they don't want to write the check.
Yeah.
If they've got a building that they've owned for 20 years, they're not feeling so good right now, but they might want to use the cash. But now they've got to pay 23% of the value of the gain versus if they just leave it to their heirs and die.
Well, it's 23% here, but through most of the United States,
it's more like
30%.
26 or 30, yeah.
And that's the point. It has gotten too high when you throw in the state taxes.
So there are places where we're beyond the sweet point, and there's places where we're below the sweet point, and the complication of the tax code makes it really hard to say what a good tax policy is.
And you can see that the business formation, development, and sales in Texas, for example, are much higher.
Because we don't have a capital gains tax here.
Because we don't have a state capital gains tax. So there's an ideal point there, and tax reform could get us to that ideal point. And if Arthur Laffer If we had Ronald Reagan as president and Arthur Laffer was advising him, and Ronald Reagan, who's quite capable of talking to both the Democrats and the Republicans and getting them to unite on something, very frankly, the tax reform is something that the Democrats and Republicans could unite on and move forward, except, and this is the key here, except that there are, and I don't know of the Democrats taking this attitude, they may take it and I don't know, but there is a significant portion of the Republicans who simply say, if the Democrats vote for it, I won't.
Right.
And without regard to the virtue of the plan, is simply, I'm going to be against everything the Democrats are for, no matter how good it is.
This is something that happens in history to our country or any country when we don't have a strong adversary. Something to unite us and say, there are bigger problems outside us than inside us, so we better all hang together or surely we'll all hang separately. That's one of the things that will unite us that we don't have. And there's threats out there, but we're not concerned about those threats enough to unite. When, you know, we've been through, we can point at leadership of the presidency, whether it be Bush or Clinton or Obama or Trump. And I don't feel like we've had exemplary leadership during any of those periods. I feel like Obama was somebody that was a great community organizer. He'd get everybody together and figure out what they want to do and then say, oh, yeah, okay, you guys go do that. But that wasn't a leadership role. Now Trump's come in and he just snipes at everybody, puts everybody at competition with each other. We need some unification in order to move forward. If we passed a health care bill right now without a single Democrat vote, as soon as they have the House or the Senate or the presidency, it's going to be the first things in the crosshair, just like it was for the Republicans. We got to figure out how to work together. We got to figure out there's some real issues here. We've got to pay our debts. We got to look at overspending versus the revenue. That's a real problem. We got to look at Social Security. We've got trust fund data that's from the Social Security Administration that says it's a serious problem coming up and it's not that far away. But right now, we're so busy staring at each other, at the twigs in each other's eyes, instead of removing the logs from our own. And we all have logs at this point. We're pointing at the forest in each other's eyes. Okay, let's all come back and recognize we're Americans. That's not easy to do. People have built their entire political careers about being against the other party. And that's how they get their votes. So we've got some other problems.
If I could change the subject, there's some other things going on out there in the world. The European Central Bank has made an interesting announcement. I think everybody who I read was expecting to see them at their meeting this last week make an announcement saying that they were going to reduce their purchases of bonds, to reduce their stimulus in the European economy.
And they did
and
not do that.
In fact, they said, nope, we're not changing anything. And the statement suggested that until Brexit is over, which is a year and a half into the future, they're not going to change anything. They want to keep the stimulus going because a couple of things. Number one, the southern tier of countries are still in something not too different from what we would call a depression. That's Spain and Italy and Greece and Portugal. And the second issue that they're running into is nobody knows the economic effect of Great Britain's leaving the common market, which is on a timer now, and the discussions and the negotiations are not going very smoothly or very quickly. So it conceivably could be a sudden yank. And that could be very destabilizing to the European economy.
Now, there are a lot of people that don't really understand what's going on here. And the easiest way to look at it is a marriage ending in divorce. A lot of the assets are co-owned. Defining not just assets are co-owned, but revenues and debts are co-owned. Defining who owes what, who gets paid what, and who owns what is what the whole process of a divorce is, and there's not a structured system to do that in the European Union. So Brexit is it's a test of a completely new negotiation style of our attorneys are going to argue with your attorneys ad nauseum, and if somebody gets too upset and just says, forget it, then it goes back to, okay, who owes that debt? And who gets paid this money?
and the issue is that there's a clock running, and at 2 years from the time of the announcement, suddenly Britain is no longer a member of the European Union, and people in Britain have to get visas to go to Europe, and people in Europe have to get visas to go to Britain, and the central financial markets for Europe are all in London, and they haven't negotiated how they're going to handle that. The Brexit issue has the potential to be devastating to the European Union, and as a result, the European Central Bank, probably with good justification, is saying, well, let's keep the life support going, things could fall apart very quickly. And this is one of those things we're going to watch going forward. It would that have an effect on the United States? Sure would. It would have an effect on our market because Europe is one of our bigger customers, and we're also one of Europe's bigger customers. And if they fall, a lot of the growth in the stock market, and I said this earlier, a lot of the things we're seeing happen positively in the stock market are because, in some cases, the majority of earnings from American corporations are in Europe and the rest of the world. Even though they're technically an American corporation, and we talked about Toyota as an example, Toyota is technically a Japanese corporation, but the majority of its shares are owned by Americans, and the majority of its manufacturing is done in the United States. And that is the nature of the global economy. It's like saying that Dell is a Texas corporation. It is incorporated in the state of Texas. But if you look at where the majority of their computers are now built, it's outside the state of Texas. So this is one of those things where we just have to recognize it's a global economy and know that what goes on over there affects us over here quite a lot.
I mean, yeah, the people that own Dell are mostly American. It's a private company now. Mostly American, but they do a lot of business overseas. Mm-hmm. So is this an American company? The people that own Toyota is definitely a global company. That's one owned by the United States and by people in Europe and by people in Japan. We have to look at ownership the way we would look at it at a state basis when we're talking about countries that we have open borders with, when we have the ability to buy things in their country or they can buy things in our country, their health becomes very important to ours. And that prevents wars, but it can also mean that bad decisions elsewhere can damage us. So there's dangers to this as well.
There's an article in the Wall Street Journal, Robots Are Replacing Workers Where You Shop, that is sort of insightful. I didn't realize how much it was true until I got to thinking about it. If you go to Walmart, you see more and more and more automated tellers. In other words, odds are if you check out at Walmart, you're going to be doing a checkout. Well, there's not anybody there running that machine. There may be one person running four machines.
Or eight.
And the end result of that is that robots are replacing workers. Now, at the same time, there's the report that came out during the
1 second. Let me throw in that just on that subject. Think of that. Hold that at the same time thought. People are complaining about the self-checkout and how long it takes. It's the same things that we complained about using a credit card when it wasn't really digitized, when they had that machine that went on your card to get it paid. It took a lot of time. It was complicated. The person had to fiddle with it. It wasn't as fast as just having cash on hand or even writing a check. Now it's the fastest way to pay. And those kiosks are quite often, those little self-pay transactions, are quite often the fastest way to get out of a store. And they're only going to get better.
Mm-hmm. Well, particularly when we get the RF tags on there, I think that'll probably...
Yeah, and then you won't have one person for four or eight, You'll have one person for all of the checkout.
Right. Basically, it'll just go through a little tunnel and it'll tell you what it costs on the
other side. Yeah.
The other thing that's going on at the same time, wages In the second quarter, for the first time since the recession, wages at the low, the bottom end of the economic spectrum are now rising faster than they are at the top. As a matter of fact, top end wages have declined slightly.
Right.
And the bottom end wages are starting to rise, which means that we're getting something that we've been waiting on a long time, which we thought we'd get a long time ago. We have very, very few. We have a shortage of employees. But the employees are now competing not only with overseas manufacturer and everything else. The ones where we have to physically be here have been competing with robots.
Yeah.
But we're starting to get to the point where the
wages still need more people. Right.
And we had a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to mention something. I don't know if it's a myth or if it's true, but this is into the future. I've been hearing this for a long time, that sooner or later they're going to have people have microchips put into their wrist or wherever they put it, and that's how they're going to be getting paid, right directly to their chip. And if they want to go shop at the store, just scan your arm across it, and it deducts whatever you owe. And I'll take my answer off the question. I didn't mean for this to be a joke question.
No.
Thank you, sir. You have a good day.
There's been discussion about that, but it's something that it might happen, but it's going to be a long time in the future.
Look, let me be this clear. I've got a phone in my pocket. Most people do. That phone is hooked up right now to Samsung Pay. It's a wireless charging phone, mm-hmm. so I can put it on a little platform and it charges itself. It's not the newest by any stretch of the Samsung phones. But when I pay for gas or pay for groceries, I hit a button on my phone and it sends through that self-charging coil the magnetic information of my credit card, just like I'd swiped it through the machine. The machine realizes that's there. I'm now carrying the cards in my phone. Okay. Is that a chip? Well, it's a lot of chips, and it's in my hand, but it's not in my hand. At some point it will, but we won't get paid to the chip. We'll get paid to an account somewhere.
I right now, nobody has come up with a means of putting a synthetic piece of silicone electronics in your body that works consistently over an extended period of time, because your body says that is something alien and begins to attack it. Now, you can put a piece of titanium in there, but as long as there's no circuits in it, it works just fine for an artificial hip. But even those have to be replaced. And
there's some thoughts about doing titanium RFID.
But I really don't see people being fitted with chips in the immediate future.
No.
For instance, I have an Apple Watch, and if I wanted to, I don't use it for that. If I wanted to and somebody had Apple Pay and I decided to pay for something, I could go up and tap my watch against the machine and it would pay. Am I doing that? No, because there's not enough people that want to do it.
Yeah, the Samsung side of things is just because they have the ability for me to use it on either a chip or a magnetic strip reader without any extra. They don't have to be on a service to do it. I just hit a button.
It's been 50 years since the general purpose credit card came into existence. It was the Bank America card. I was involved in the rollout of that thing 50 years ago. I remember it very clearly. And we're still using credit cards. Now, admittedly, they got chips in them and all kinds of things. 50 years from now, it's possible that somebody might be using a chip embedded in their wrist.
It's not going to be needed. A chip won't be needed. It's just an identifier.
The idea is, I think it'll be more likely that there'll be a biometric scan of your irises or something.
And it won't be 50 years. That'll be relatively soon. Relatively soon being the next decade or two. That's just really...
Right now I use my Apple. I can use my Apple phone. In order to use my Apple Pay on the Apple phone, I have to put my fingerprint on it, which is biometric, which I think is where the future is on this.
I just, for the fun of it, because this is what I am rather than watching a new action movie, I watched a documentary from 1966 on the future, what we should expect to see in 1999, which Was it? I mean, it's a generation away from them, but we're almost the same distance in the future from 99 as they were separated by them. We've got some time to go still, but the idea here is that they thought there was going to be a central computer in the house that stored all your money. The computer in your house had your money on it. The reality is that there are a lot of computers at the banks all over the country and the world that have your money on it, and you use your computer to go to them. So they were thinking still in the terms of you have a safe and you put your money in it. That's what the question here implies too. The money's not going to be in a chip or in the credit card. It's on a computer or a lot of computers at a bank.
Well, in a sense, could I add something to
sure.
that? This sounds like I'm going to change the subject, but I'm not. IBM and Amazon are in a horse race. Microsoft and Amazon are in a horse race for something that IBM should have won. And you think, well, okay, Amazon started off as a bookseller online and now just sells everything online. And then Microsoft is over here making variations of Windows and software and Surface computers. What have they got in common? And the answer is they see their big future, both of them, in the cloud. And most of us, I think, don't even know what the cloud is. The cloud is basically
server space.
Decentralized servers that are all over the country running the same program, so that if one set of servers were to go down or be nuked or whatever, the other ones would work just fine. But it enables, and you're using the cloud all the time, whether you know it or not. When you use your credit card, you're using the cloud.
Right.
Because the point is it enables your data and your computation to occur wherever you are, whatever operating system you're using, so that, for example, I have an Apple computer, I have a Windows computer, they both can access the same data in the cloud. Our business access, it stores the data in the cloud, so that if our business is wiped out, the data will still be there. We can still function from another location. That is the big thing happening. And if you want to know where your money is in reality, we think of money as being cash in the vault of the bank. That just ain't so. Your money is electronic records and electronic signals, most of which are dwelling in encrypted files in the cloud. And if that doesn't, you know, when you start thinking about that and you loop in the issues on the Federal Reserve, and you realize that almost all the money in the United States is in, quote, the cloud,
right,
somewhere, it becomes mind-boggling. It works.
There are a couple of big factors here. The danger that people see here is that we're going to get rid of cash, that we're not going to have any anonymity in any purchases that we do. If you want to hand somebody $20, how do you do that? Well, there's ways you can do that, and millennials and Xers are already doing it. You can use PayPal. You can use Venmo. There's a lot of different ways that you can transfer money back and forth to each other using your phone. There's also, you can hand them cash. Cash is not going to go away anytime soon. We're still using the penny. I mean,
that makes no sense at all.
It doesn't make sense because we have No sense. We have a reluctance to get rid of cash. So it's going to be around a long time. The chip concept about how you pay, when I say you don't need it, that's not to say we're not going to have chips in our body. The technology that's being worked on right now, DARPA's got a big program where they're looking at putting in a chip into the brain that's connecting with 100,000 neurons, which right now we're in the 8 or 9 range when we're doing this with animals or with people.
8 or 9 what?
8 or 9 neurons. That's it. That's all we are doing when we're doing Parkinson's or a lot of the other research. It's 8 or 9 neurons. DARPA, which is the Defense Armed Services Research arm, it's a very large arm. They're funding a bunch of research
arm of the armed services.
And before the Democrats out there get up in arms about
we need an arms treaty
about DARPA. DARPA is the reason why we have self-driving cars. So this is, you know, they're the ones that funded the research at the academic level that Google came up and bought. So they have gone a long ways with that research since then. But keep that in mind. we will have computer-human interfaces that are inside our body. It already happens if you have a pacemaker. It's just very low level. There are a lot of things that will be happening inside our body, but monetary transactions don't require that. You're going to have some other thing that does a lot of other things for you that also does money. It's not going to be a chip that just does money. That's kind of, you know, that would be counter everything that we're doing. The fact that we used to think that we would have a central computer in our home that did all the things for us. Well, that's kind of true, except that it isn't. If you want your lights controlled in your house, you've got an app that does that, but the computer's, you might have a computer in the house, but it's not really the one that's controlling it. It goes out to a server somewhere and sends that information back in. We're becoming more and more decentralized, not centralized. And if you centralize to one chip having all your money in it, then what happens if you're in a car accident and you lose the chip? The money's not in the chip. And that's kind of the biggest answer to that, that the science fiction of the past that says everybody's going to get chipped or tattooed.
We probably need to do commercials.
Yes, we do.
Because I got some other things on a different subject I'd like to talk about.
Okay. We'll be back on the other side of this break with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call us, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. I'm Jake. That's Jeff. And we'll be back on the other side.
Keeping cool is serious.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Hey, and I got a series of very interesting, well, to me, I'm a geek, interesting things. There's an article in Barron's called The Baffling Mystery of Inflation Deflation. The fact is that we saw inflation coming up towards like 1.7% by one measure, by the personal consumption index. Early in the year, and it has slipped back. I mean, it slipped back so far that if we take the consumer price index, the core elements of the consumer price index, and strip out one item, that's shelter cost. In other words, the fact that house prices are rising, our year-over-year inflation is 0.6%, which is tiny, way too tiny. There is a unemployment down to 4.4%. Normally, at this point, the Phillips curve says unemployment at 4.4%.
Is he the same guy that did the screwdriver?
He may be.
This is Phillips screwdriver, Phillips curve. Okay.
Could be Phillips 66, too, but that's beside the point. The issue is, as an economist, and it was called the Phillips curve, and basically the lower unemployment gets, the higher inflation goes. Well, it just isn't working. We're seeing something that I think was generally unexpected. And it's certainly probably when the Fed Reserve meets next week, I think they're going to say, nope, we're not raising interest rates. And the reason they're going to say that is because inflation is approaching zero. And the purpose in the Fed's raising interest rates, the Fed has two major goals. One, protect the value of the dollar. In other words, hold off inflation. And number two, achieve full employment. And we are pretty close to full employment. And we don't have, and inflation is dropping. It's also dropping in Europe, and that's causing the European Central Bank. It's dropping in Korea. So we're seeing inflation go down all over, and it's probably caused by a lot of things. But one of the things that's happening, and this is worrisome, the U.S. working population annual growth 10 years ago was 1.3% a year. We had to have 144,000 new jobs made every month in order just to keep up with the growth in the working population of the United States.
Right.
Now we're down to 75 to 100,000 is all we need because the working population growth is 0.5%.
And the reason it's a net growth because right. There's a lot of baby boomers that are saying, hey, I'm 67, yeah. I'm out of here. Or, hey, I'm 70 and I'm out of here. They want to retire. They've been planning for it for a long time.
And the same thing's happening in Europe and Japan, only far more accelerated.
Yes,
rate. They actually have a shrinking
working population at this point.
So we have a relatively youth and healthy, young and healthy working population. But the point is, as people retire, they spend less money than before they retired. That's one of the strange conundrums. You'd think that with all that spare time on their hand, they'd spend more money, but they don't. They spend less money. And so what we've – and corporations at the same time are far more focused on cost-cutting than they are on risk-taking. And again, this is where I think a little tax reform that would provide some changes. Among other – for example, when I say tax reform, our tax code right now favors borrowing over capital investing. If you borrow – then you get to deduct the interest on the loan. If you capital invest, you put money into something, you have to stretch out the depreciation over a long period of time, and it becomes sort of awkward. So we've got a problem there, and the profit growth in the United States is really good, but most of it, meaning U.S. S&P 500 corporations, but it's coming from overseas, and that isn't bad necessarily, because if you've got an investment portfolio, it means that your investment portfolio is growing very nicely, while retail sales in the United States over the last 12 months only grew 1.2%.
And they grew mostly online, which we had a shrinkage in retail sales in your brick and mortar company. So there's a transition happening there as well.
And, you know, we're just talking to a person who has a family who does huge farms with combines that drive themselves all over Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Huge gazillion acre farms and he asked his brother.
Mm-hmm.
He said his brother-in-law says, "How many are you having trouble finding good employees?" He says, "Well, I don't need them."
Why do you need employees? You got GPS.
I just turn the combines on and they go out and harvest the field and come back.
Yeah, the extra work that they do is stopping traffic when they take the combines out on the road. So there's one person involved that stands out and stops traffic while all the combines go driving by in the short places where
they have to cross.
So it still requires people for that until the cars are driving themselves, and then that won't even require people.
And we talked to the guy who called in last hour, our manufacturing output in the United States is at a record high right now. As a portion of our economy, it is quite healthy. We have a large manufacturing output.
As a portion of jobs, it's a
low.
Lot less than it was.
And that's the same thing in agriculture.
There's a very clear, you said, you started to bring this up, that we have less than 1% of our population involved in agriculture, but in the year 1900, we had 80% of our population involved in agriculture. That's a massive difference.
Mm-hmm. And yet we are either number one or number two, I don't remember which.
In agricultural
production. We're number two in agricultural production in the world, but if you look at the number of people we have in agriculture compared with anybody else, we have a tiny, tiny fraction. Who's number one right now?
Russia. Russia, and it's
intermittently.
Intermittently, Russia's back and forth.
All depends on how good the weather is on the steppes.
They have a lot of land, though.
They have a lot of land and a lot of people employed in agriculture.
And I'm going to throw in six states here: Alabama, Connecticut, Illinois, Michigan, Mississippi, New Mexico, Ohio, and Wyoming.
That's eight. That's
eight states.
Yeah, okay. You always had trouble with those numbers.
Yes, numbers, those number things. So what do they have in common? They have less employment today than they did at the top of the market before the recession.
Mm-hmm.
They are still in a recession.
From an economic point of view, they're not, but from an employment point of view.
They're in an employment recession, and that's one of the factors that is now being used to measure recessions.
But Connecticut remains the highest output state per square mile.
Right, and Connecticut's got less employment. It's got industrial output is way up there, but less employment than it had before the recession.
And Elon Musk gave a warning this week about that. Did you know that?
He gave a lot of good stuff. Which particular one?
He warned the governors that AI has the capability of displacing most workers, if not all workers in the United States.
Yeah. Now, let's flip to some other states that are at record low unemployment, records for the history of their states.
Okay.
Not just from the recession, but
from the history.
Right? North Dakota, Arkansas. California.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a reason for Arkansas, though.
There's a lot of reasons for Arkansas.
There's a particular reason for Arkansas.
Arkansas, California, Tennessee,
right,
and Washington, the state, not the district.
But Tennessee and Arkansas, I just got through reading an article about that. The reason they have very, very low unemployment is because people are leaving those. Their populations
Correct.
Are dropping like
that's,
a rock.
That's what was the next thing I was going to come in. Arkansas and Tennessee have had a massive exodus to Colorado, California, and Texas.
Yes, yes.
So when if you're in Arkansas, a lot of people came to Texas for work, which meant that as a percentage of their working population got smaller, which allowed the businesses that were still there to hire a larger percentage of the working population, mm-hmm. which caused the unemployment rate to drop.
But businesses are leaving now, starting to leave some of those states.
Correct.
Arkansas and Connecticut,
Tennessee, they're starting to see businesses leave.
Because they can't
elsewhere.
Find workers.
Right.
You know, there's an interesting – I assumed years ago, and years ago on the radio program, I recall saying – I hope I did. Remember saying this correctly, that as the internet came online, this radio show now has been around longer than the internet, which is
not the entire internet, but
but the actual common use of the world wide web.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, we were on the air in 97, so the internet existed before that,
but it wasn't used by people.
No, the dot-com bubble was the big thing at the time.
But the point is that I anticipated that there would be a decentralization as people moved out of the cities into more rural environments where they could work wherever they were. In fact, what we're seeing demographically in the United States is the reverse of that. We're seeing small towns across the country dry up and go away. We're seeing hospitals closing all over the country because there's not enough people to use the hospital to make it profitable to keep the hospital open.
And then hospitals expanding in cities.
Right.
Real estate prices rising drastically in cities because people are leaving the rural areas and coming to cities.
What we're seeing across the country is something that I was unaware of until I started reading about it and checking on it. And that is the inner city areas that we used to consider blighted and disaster areas.
You were unaware of this?
Are quickly becoming the centers of new innovation, new housing, and for upscale people. Now, I don't know where all those poor people went.
I can tell you all about it.
Where did they go?
It's called gentrification, by the way.
But where did the poor people go?
The extreme left-wing people are saying this is a horrible thing. The extreme right people are not really noticing, and the people that are in business are saying this is great. So this is a non-political entity, which is probably why it's not been in the news much. But gentrification is what the term is. They take these blighted inner cities, and what happens is it starts with a few people coming in and buying up property, and it's close to where they work in downtown. They don't want to drive a long ways because traffic is getting bad because there's so many people coming to the city. So they buy a piece of the inner city, and they buy the piece and then wreck the house and build a beautiful thing or not so beautiful thing, depending on the taste of the person. And over time, more and more people do that. It causes the price of the real estate around that house to go up, which causes the property taxes to go up, which causes the people who've lived in this area for decades and decades to say, I can't afford the taxes anymore, so I need to sell the property. They get a lot more for the property than they expected to get, and so they move just north or just south of the city and buy a house that's three times the size, but it takes an inner city population, which is extremely segregated, and spreads them out amongst the rest of the population.
Well,
it's what happened to Chinatowns all over the country at the last urban revitalization.
But this is the end result of this, and this is something that I'd kind of seen it around the edges, but I was just not overly aware until it came up in the healthcare bill, and I started looking at it. Throughout the Midwest, in rural communities – there's an opioid epidemic, it's called. Opioid epidemic. A lot of people are getting hooked on heroin or a derivative of heroin. That's what used to occur.
Not heroin. It's mostly prescription drugs.
But that's the thing that was occurring in the inner city, and it's now occurring in rural America. And
right.
If you look, it's mostly Caucasians that this is occurring with, and it's basically the lower – education, lower income groups, which are becoming – this sounds really weird – becoming more and more concentrated in a spread out area of rural America. Now, that how do you concentrate in a spread out area? And what's happening is the education levels and the income levels and housing values and all that stuff we think of as with a growing economy is becoming more concentrated in the cities.
And with exceptions, Detroit is not going in the same
Detroit
direction.
Detroit is actually
The inner city is starting to get nice. It's just all of the areas that what you would used to consider the city that isn't anymore.
I looked up what's going on in Detroit, and apparently there's some pretty smart people, because apparently people with big money are going and buying up whole blighted neighborhoods.
Yeah, well, they
leveling
are
it and renovating it into something that would be attractive, and people are coming and living there.
Right.
So they're starting to flow back into Detroit. But it's not the people who were there before. It's not the auto worker who was there before.
And that's an important piece to throw in here. Those first eight states that I read off that still have higher unemployment than they did before the recession started, those eight states, Illinois and Michigan are two of those states. Illinois is still in a lot of trouble, and they can't figure out what to do. Michigan has not revised its tax code. It's still thinking like they have this massive booming economy that a little extra taxes isn't going to hurt it too badly.
Where is that?
This is Michigan.
Okay,
we're
it's
Detroit.
Also Connecticut, by the way.
Yeah, and Connecticut. But Connecticut's got a different situation because it was a much more spread out industrial area.
Right.
In Michigan, their taxes became very overburdensome, but as long as the huge companies were what were being taxed, it was fine. The same's true in Illinois. When that industry left, Illinois and Michigan haven't adjusted how they tax, which means it's nearly impossible to start a new business there still. Until they get that part figured out, their unemployment rate's still going to be higher than it was in the recession. Well, because new businesses are going to go somewhere else. People are going to continue to leave. And if the businesses are leaving faster than the workers, then the unemployment rate's going to go up, not down. If the workers are leaving faster than the businesses, and the businesses are just hiring up anybody that didn't have a job, unemployment rates go down.
And this is this strange set of circumstances occurring across the country. The number of net layoffs versus net hires — we're hiring more people than we're laying off, obviously — but if you look at the number of layoffs in the United States, the absolute number, we're approaching an all-time record. It is currently the lowest since 1973. And when you consider that the economy was only a fraction the size of the United States in 1973,
right,
as a percentage of the workforce, we have the lowest layoff rate in the history of the nation going on right now. This is every indication of a very healthy economy, but we're growing very slowly, and we have extremely low inflation. As a matter of fact, inflation is so low, it's almost negative, and in some ways it is. The price of food is going down in the grocery stores nationwide. We're in one of those positions that it's uncharted territory.
Right. If you ignore politics, if you ignore what's going on basically on the news, and just look around your life at the quality of your life right now, you are likely at the peak of your life as far as quality goes from the past. It may keep going higher.
I think it will.
We're able to eat more and better food. We're able to live in larger houses. We're able to have more and better cars. We're able to have air conditioning everywhere. I mean, there was in the news here, there was a little riot over with pepper spray sprayed out over a jail in a small town that didn't have.
I thought it was in St. Louis.
Oh, it's in St. Louis. Okay,
that's a small town.
It's
St.
small,
Louis.
Small town, St. Louis. It didn't have air conditioning. Yeah, in my childhood, no jails had air conditioning. Are you insane? Why would you put air conditioning in a jail? Well, because that's an expectation. It has to do with, as our comfort level, as our standard of living increases, our standards on what we require to remain comfortable rise with them. We've got to keep those in line with our ability to spend and our ability to earn. It's a pretty common sense thought, but somehow every once in a while we tend to forget common sense.
We're in a tremendously booming economy that doesn't appear to be booming.
Right, because if you look at the news, there's no headlines about it. We've had so many record-breaking headlines that they aren't really that important anymore.
Speaking of breaking records, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we are coming to the end of our second hour on this July 22nd, 2017. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we are in the business of wealth management for higher net worth people, and our telephone number is 254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free, voicemail during the weekends, real-life people during the week, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and read our newsletter, listen to the podcast of this episode and many others. Read our philosophy, see our made-for-radio faces, and our beautiful staff. Do you have some thoughts you wanted to leave the audience with before we go?
Yeah, we're in great shape. Watch your congressman. Frankly, in looking around the economy, the biggest threat to the United States of America is Congress right now. Congress is capable of crippling the economic expansion that we're in, and let's just hope and pray they don't, and let's not encourage them to do so, but let's encourage them to behave in a rational, responsible fashion. And yeah, that means that we either are going to have the government spend less money or we're going to pay more taxes, but that's okay.
Right. So thank you very much for listening, everyone. Our economy's in great shape. We've got dangers on the horizon as usual. I think we're capable. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.